Yesterday, we discussed sort of this general framework for understanding Penrose processes, and wrote down how you consider the total energy integrated on some time slice, or basically two different time slices corresponding to some initial time and some final time, that the difference between that was equal to basically the amount of flux you had going into the black hole. You know, gaining some energy here would correspond to a negative flux of energy out of the black hole. So today we're going to sort of give an example of a process where you can arrange to have this negative flux of energy out of black hole, in particular a process known as superradiance. It's another example of this generalized Penrose processes. But before we go into that, I also want to talk about sort of the relative roles of the ergosphere and the black hole horizon in extracting energy from a black hole. So we kind of think we have the black hole horizon, and then we have this ergosphere. Outside the black hole horizon. So, you know, the ergosphere is kind of essential in being able to create these sort of allowing you to have negative energy density with respect to your killing vector, or creating these, you know, time-like particles that carry negative energy as measured by our killing vector associated with our stationary spacetime. But on the other hand, you know, from expressions like this, we know that the total energy going from one time slice to the next time slice is always going to be the same unless we have a flux through the black hole horizon, right? Just the conservation of energy. So, you know, a question you might that sort of might occur to you is, what happens if we have a very compact, rapidly rotating star? In that case, it's actually possible to have an ergo region, but no black hole horizon.
Mentioned that in a sphere, we are going to have particles with negative energy.
Yeah. So, like, for example, we went through this like particle Penrose process, right, where you, you know, have some particle that comes into the ergosphere, and then it splits into one that falls into the black hole, and one that goes out. And you know, for this one that falls in, if you look at the energy, the killing energy associated with this quantity for time-like geodesics that are within the ergosphere, you can arrange for this to be negative. So that was how.
I always thought that having a positive energy is kind of like a really strong constraint. Like, otherwise, we're going to have like exotic matter.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's important to sort of distinguish between two different types of energy, right? So one would be locally, some observer tries to measure the energy of this particle, right? So that would correspond to this observer with power velocity UA. This would be energy observed by this observer, this particle. And yeah, that has to be positive. But this one doesn't have to be positive, exactly for the reason that this vector, this killing vector is time-like outside the error region. but within the Earth region, it becomes space-like. So it doesn't actually correspond to any local observer.
So the observer itself doesn't count that as its energy, right? So I want to know what's the physical interpretation of that. Like, I'm having like a T as a coordinate time, and I'm going to say that for that special observer, if I found out combination, I'm just calling that some kind of energy. I have no idea what's the physical interpretation of that. Like, for that one, we can just say that, okay, that's the energy that the observer would actually feel about itself, but I have no idea what...
Yeah, so you can think of this as like the locally observed thing,
yeah.
But this is the globally conserved quantity.
Okay.
That's the basic difference. So even though locally you wouldn't measure the energy be negative, still, you know, all the thing that has to add up the you know, the same as some initial time to some final time is this energy. Like, these energies don't have to be conserved, right? Because they're sort of depend on the particular observer.
Thank you.
All right, good questions. So we don't know if there are any particular like astrophysical rotating stars that have Erg regions, but you can certainly construct them, and they're not pathological, they don't violate any energy conditions or stuff like that. A question is like, can you still have, for example, the particle Penrose process for the space-time as opposed to this one? Anyone want to take a guess about that? The question is, so here we talked about for the black hole case having this particle Penrose process, right, where basically the energy we come out with is going to be greater than the energy we came in with, right? And that all adds up because this particle that falls into the black hole actually carries negative energy, you know, as measured this way. So the question is, if we have star with no horizon that still has an Erg region, can you have something like this? You know, basically, can you have a Penrose process without a horizon?
I can't find any logical reason, but it seems it should be possible, but the answer is no.
Yeah, so, I mean, locally, when you do this, right, you're not using the fact that you have a horizon at all, right? So you can certainly try to arrange for something like this. For this case, what will happen is you'll just have, some particle. It can escape with greater energy. You'll just have some particle with negative energy measured this way. It will just be confined to the Erg region, right? Because as long as it has this negative energy, it can't actually escape the Erg region.
You need to have a thermal region.
Hmm?
Like, that Erg region has to exist for all eternity. Otherwise,
it escapes,
right?
Yeah, I mean, we're just considering on the background of some space-time for the purpose of this thought experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's that particle could still go and hit the star, right? Just become a part of the star.
Yeah, So I mean, you can kind of think of it as, want to think about it in terms of money. You know, when you do this process, you're kind of charging something on your credit card. So, you can buy something, you can get out extra energy, and you just have some debt right here. You have some negative energy, and when it goes through the black hole horizon, you can cash it out. And think of it as decreasing the black hole's mass. In this case, it'll just kind of float around, at least if we're just considering it on the background of some space-time. If you want to consider how it might backtrack on the star, again, you would probably expect it to slow the rotation of the star because it basically has the opposite angular momentum for the same reason. I just kind of want to emphasize the relative importance of the Erg region and the horizon. It's really the Erg region that allows you to create these negative energy states. And in fact, this case is kind of actually more unstable than this one. You can imagine if you create some negative energy state within the erg region here, it's confined to be there, right? But if it's not stationary, if it oscillates or something like that, then it can emit radiation, right? So basically, it'll lose energy to infinity. But because it's a negative energy state, it means it'll become kind of greater and greater magnitude. To go to more negative energy, you would expect to create more radiation and actually give you a runaway instability. So you can actually prove, and so this is a result going back to Friedman, and I think the 70s, that basically any space-time that has an ergo region, but it doesn't have a black hole horizon, or in fact, I think it's even if you just say the ergo region is disconnected from the black hole horizon, it doesn't touch it anywhere, so you can never have dissipation in the ergo region, and that actually gives rise to this linear instability. Okay. So next I wanted to discuss going back to considering some field on the background of the black hole, talk about super radiance. So this is kind of the wave analog of the Penrose process. And so we'll consider the simplest type of wave, which is just a massless scalar field. Or you can also call it the massless Klein-Gordon equation. So we have box phi, where box here is just the covariant derivative contracted itself is equal to zero. And then associated with this, we have a stress energy tensor. We're just going to consider a wave solution that has the following form. We can kind of separate into a part that just depends on your radial and theta component. And then has one fixed frequency omega and one azimuthal number m. This basically tells you the number of times if you go around 2 pi the azimuth direction that this field oscillates. And here I'm just taking the real part. Okay, so we're going to use the expression from yesterday to calculate the flux of energy into the black hole horizon for this particular stress energy tensor.
not in the equatorial plane anymore, right?
No. So I for the purpose of this, I don't have to tell you like what it does in theta. So yeah, it could do anything in the theta direction. But we're considering a wave, we're not considering particles. Take the integral over the horizon, and we take the normal to the horizon. Okay, so that's the flux of energy into the black hole horizon. So we're going to plug in that stress energy tensor. This expression, and now this actually simplifies because so here we have the normal to the black hole horizon. Here we have our time like Killing vector, and so if you contract the two, you actually get zero. You can kind of think of it as, you know, with the downstairs, here you have a normal to surface of constant r, so it's only going to have a r component here. And we can simplify that further. If we plug in this specific ansatz that I wrote down for the wave. Collecting terms. Okay. So this quantity here has to be greater than or equal to zero. So this tells us basically that the flux of energy into the black hole will become negative exactly when then this quantity is less than zero. In particular, if we choose the frequency of our gravitation of our scalar wave to be less than the horizon frequency of the black hole times the azimuthal number of our wave, but still positive greater than zero, then we'll have this. Then we'll actually get a flux of energy out of the black hole.
And there is an omega in between.
There's omega there too.
So that we are assuming always positive also. The integral is always positive.
So this is positive. So in particular, if I satisfy this, then this will be positive and this will be negative, right?
Yeah. Okay. I see. Okay.
Yeah, so basically you can think of it as you have two different limits. You know, one as you approach the frequency of a wave being the same as the rise in frequency of the black hole, then extraction of energy actually goes to zero. And the other limit is that the frequency goes to zero. So that's kind of same as the wavelength becoming very long compared to the black hole. And then that limits the flux of energy into the black hole also goes to zero. Think of it in that case, it's just like a very long wavelength, scalar wave that basically doesn't fuel the black hole. But we could have probably already guessed this without going through this exact calculation if we had just basically written down the energy, the ratio of the energy and angular momentum carried by a wave. So for a wave that's just, you know, a fixed frequency and has a Muth number, that's just given by this. So, you know, this condition here is actually exactly the same as this general condition we wrote down on the ratio of energy and angular momentum for some wave or particle that you're throwing into the black hole.
It's really opposite.
That's
opposite, right? Omega should be bigger.
I write that wrong.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's correct.
This is also correct, it seems.
Yeah, sorry. There you go.
Also, we don't need M, right? Because M is.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Right. M's there.
I don't. I thought the earlier sign was right. The notes that we had. Because
I think the first equation has a minus because that becomes I, the derivative respect to time becomes I omega to the power 2. So it gives the overall minus to the second line. Maybe it is the overall minus. If we count the first line to second line, there is a overall minus sign, I think. Just let's check the derivative respect to time. We have rho t psi to the power 2, but rho t psi is I omega. So
yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think this is correct right here. That looks correct.
This one is the water.
Yeah, I think, well, I might have, I think maybe the confusion is just the inner, like the whether or not you define this to be the energy into the black hole or out of the black hole. But I think if we're defining this to be the energy that you're basically extracting, this delta E here, so it's like the energy associated with the wave, then I think I have the right signs here.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, sorry, that might be slightly confusing, whether it's into the black hole or out of the black hole. So any other questions about that?
Can you talk a bit about the physics of this psi, this wave? Like, what is that exactly? It's like a photon, for instance, we are going to...
I can briefly mention about super radiance for other fields. So this is particular just the scalar field. So photon would be, for a vector field. So I guess the scalar we know about is the Higgs or something. So not terribly astrophysically relevant, but it's kind of the simplest wave equation you could have. And maybe that's a good segue to, so I can just write down that, you basically get this super radiance for sort of any type of wave. You can have it for electromagnetic waves. You can actually have it for gravitational waves too. And to actually calculate the efficiency of the scattering, you have to basically solve the wave equation on the background of a curved space time. So we'll talk a little bit about that towards the end of the class. But for now, just note that if you try to go through that calculation and see what the maximum efficiency you can get for the scattering process, so how much you send a wave with some energy, how much do you get back? Not surprisingly, you get maximum efficiency for an extreme old black hole. And it turns out to depend on the spin of the field you're considering. So for scalar waves, it's actually not that efficient. You can actually only get up to 0.3% efficiency. For vector waves, or the electromagnetic wave, you can go up to 4.4%. And then for gravitational waves, it becomes much more significant. Go to 138%.
What is the definition of efficiency? Delta E over the energy of radiation, something like that?
So this would say that the difference between the energy you put in and the energy you get out is this times the energy put in. So for like a scalar wave, you put in some energy, you get out 1.003 times that energy. Yeah, so in the super radiance case, you imagine just have some incoming wave from affinity, the black hole kind of then reflects back out with some carrying slightly more energy than it came in. But that's that scattering just happens once. So you might imagine if there's any way to sort of convert that to an instability, have the black hole continuously interact with the wave. So there's this idea, going back to Preston-Tucholsky, of what if you could take a spinning black hole and enclose it in some mirror? So then you have your wave interacts with the black hole, reflects back out, or scattered back out, then comes back in again. So you have this reflecting mirror and just keeps interacting each time. And so it's growing, and the amount of energy you extract is some multiple of the amount of energy you put in. So that actually give you an instability. They call this the black hole bomb. And so, you know, we don't really know the nature of any sufficiently big mirrors to surround astrophysical black holes. The next thing I'm going to talk about how you can have a confining mechanism or a wave interacting with a black hole. So that's a case where you have, instead of a massless scalar, you have a massive scalar.
Do you know more or less the number for not A equals 1, but A equals 0.09, like astrophysical black holes, of what is the efficiency for gravitational waves?
Yeah, I don't know that number off the top of my head, but it does reduce as you go down. Yeah.
Is that significant if one were to model the ring down? It's like when you have a merger, you will get that the black hole that you form, like take a snapshot right after the merger,
mm-hmm.
and you have some gravitational waves coming in.
Yeah, that's a good question. So actually, it turns out these ring down gravitational waves are actually always above this frequency, as opposed to being below this frequency. Actually, in the extremal limit, the quasi-neural modes approach this frequency from above, and then the maximum frequency of super radiance approaches this from below. But the quasi-neural modes, kind of by construction, because they're quasi-normal, are the ones that they actually decay, part due to radiation to infinity, in part.
I'm not thinking of like how it breakdowns, but kind of like you had two black holes that were in spiraling, so they were emitting gravitational waves.
Yeah.
So you had some gravitational waves that were emitted by smaller black holes, and then they hit at some point later a bigger black hole that has formed. So then maybe those would have that condition.
For the particular case of like creating some gravitational waves from in one place and then have it interacting with a black hole elsewhere, in principle you could have that. So if sort of the emitter is far away from the black hole, so here we're kind of thinking of like some like spherical wave or something that will be incoming on the black hole, in the case you're thinking about, it'd be more sort of like a plane wave or something like that. So the efficiency of this, the super radiance process, is also sort of suppressed for these higher angular number waves. Will be more appropriate for these plane waves. So in principle, that could happen, though I think in practice it turns out to not be that big of an effect. Another kind of related thing is like, if you have two rapidly spinning black holes and they're kind of in spiraling, there is this, it's not a huge effect, but it is there that we can actually spin down the black holes a bit before they merge. So you can kind of think of this either as a manifestation of like the super radiance, or kind of like a spin orbit coupling or something, where you're kind of reducing the rotation of the black hole and putting that into the orbit / the gravitational waves. Yeah, so actually, I can also mention that besides the black hole bomb, another way to kind of, besides have a mirror, another setting where you kind of naturally have a mirror is an asymptotically entered sitter space. So So, you know, in that case, you have this like time-like boundary, right? And if you apply sort of reflecting boundary conditions here, then you can also show that you get an instability for like a spinning, like for example, in Kerr anti-de-Sitter spacetimes, as long as the spinning black hole is kind of sufficiently small compared to the ADS radius. And you know, another probably the most like astrophysically relevant one of this energy extraction from black hole would be in black hole jets. Imagine you know, you have some accretion disk or something of a you know, magnetized plasma, and then it basically creates magnetic field lines. And holds them onto the black hole. What Blanford and Zanayak showed is that you can actually get some of these field lines that are forced to rotate by the black hole. And so the rotating field lines are, if you consider the ratio of their angular momentum to energy, you know, they're exactly satisfying this condition to have a negative flux of energy into the black hole. So these field lines rotate and carry away a pointing flux at the expense of spinning down the black hole.
So can you explain that again, please? I didn't get that.
Yeah, so in this case, we have some electromagnetic fields that are kind of anchored by an accretion disk here. And so that keeps these sort of magnetic field lines, you know, you're holding them so you have like a flux of electromagnetic energy on the black hole horizon. You know, when the black hole is rotating, it'll actually force these field lines to, you know, basically the, you know, all the field lines that you know enter into the black hole's ergo region will be forced to rotate, like they basically carry a flux of energy and angular momentum just in the electromagnetic fields. You again look at a black hole horizon for those types of solutions, then they exactly satisfy this condition. You have a negative flux of this electromagnetic energy into the black hole. All right, so now we're going to talk about massive scalar fields as opposed to the massless case we just considered. Again, we have the Klein coordinate equation. Or here mu is the mass. You can think that you know, you have some boson, it's the mass of the boson up to a factor of h bar. So we're going to just focus on the case where a Compton wavelength is much bigger than the size of the black hole. That's sort of the non-relativistic limit. And that'll make our lives easier because we can sort of you know, ignore the sort for the purpose of calculating these bound states, we can actually ignore the black hole spin, and then just calculate the sort of non-relativistic bound states associated with these. So if we write out this box operator, and get the following. Yeah, and here I'm using this very useful identity that hopefully you've seen before, that you take the covariant divergence of some vector, you can write it in terms of the ordinary derivative like this. All right, so we're in this limit, we're basically going to ignore the black hole spin. And so for Schwarzschild, we have that the minus the metric determinant square root of that is going to be r times sine squared, or sine theta. And then we can simplify this. And here, the GTT component just the leading order and M over R is just that. And basically, we're assuming that the momentum is non-relativistic, so we only keep this this metric component here.
So making that non-relativistic assumption, we are validly treating in Schwarzschild means non-rotating case. Means I don't understand how. Why are we looking at Schwarzschild and not curl?
If you're sitting far away from the black hole, the spin of the black hole is sort of a subleading effect. It is essential that it's spinning to be able to extract energy. Right now I'm just going to show that you can have these bound states, basically regardless of the spin or not. We'll talk about how you can turn that into instability. All right, so we use the ansatz. We're at some fixed frequency omega, and plug that in. Following. We can simplify this a little bit further.
So.
And finally, so we're going to use the fact that omega, since we're sort of non-relativistic, is just mu up to some small correction. So then we can simplify this to be all right, so.
Excuse me, why omega and mu are approximately the same? You're choosing omega and mu to be approximately the same there?
Yeah, so you know, here we have omega minus mu times omega plus mu, and I, like when I just approximate that as two times mu. This is the, you know, the, they have a, you know, massive non-relativistic solution. Then, you know, sort of the total energy is approximately just the rest mass. Yeah, so does this equation look familiar to anyone?
This is 1D particle.
Yeah, Schrodinger equation with 1 by r potential.
Yep, exactly. So this would be the equation that you would solve to get the levels of a hydrogen atom in quantum mechanics. So here we have the sort of following identifications. And we have our fine structure constant. Alpha. And that's just going to be the mass of the black hole times the mass of the boson. And then we have our energy here. I'm just going to be this term here. You know, so using quantum mechanics, we know that's going to be given by this. And then we also have our Bohr radius. Yeah, so just making all those identifications, basically know that the solution is going to be controlled by this fine structure constant. So implicitly, by taking this limit, we're basically doing an expansion small alpha. And we're going to have, you know, different energy levels. And for the characteristic side of this size of this cloud, it's going to be given by this Bohr radius, which is this combination of alpha and mu. Yeah, and so, so basically all of the, you know, different solutions you get for the Schrödinger equation, you know, in particular, sort of the most or the one that would grow fastest to this super instability I mentioned would be sort of the, you know, low angular number one, where you have the L and M quantum numbers to 1. In that case, you get something like 2 here. We get a spherical harmonic. And so the only difference here is that for the hydrogen atom, you just have some central nucleus of your atom at r equals 0. But here we're imagining you have a black hole horizon. So if we go back to the case where we're considering the black hole spin, there's an additional calculation that I'm not going to do, but basically, if you choose this frequency omega to exactly be in the superheated regime, then if you calculate the flux on this black hole horizon, then again you get a flux of energy out of the black hole as opposed to into that. And so you won't just have solutions that have real frequency, but actually have a complex frequency. That's the imaginary part is associated with this dissipation to the black hole horizon. So the real part, we just get the energy level, some Schrodinger equation type solutions. And this imaginary part is going to be, turns out, much smaller than the real part, in particular in this non-relativistic approximation. But it will give you an instability if you arrange for this superrating condition. And so you can, and given what I said before about you get for maximum efficiency from superradiance, when you're this number is not much smaller than this, but it's sort of comparable to this. From this, we can deduce that we basically want the Compton wavelength of our boson to be comparable to the size of an astrophysical black hole for this instability to have the fastest time scale. So if we kind of restore physical units, that actually corresponds to very, very light boson. So if we're talking about a black hole of 10 solar masses, that would be something like 10 to the minus 12 electron volts for the mass of this boson. So we don't really know of any standard model particles that fit this bill, but there are definitely a number of particles that people have speculated about. For example, the QCD axion or dark photons or things like that. And so observing spinning black holes is actually a way that you can look for these ultralight bosons that might be maybe dark particles that are very weakly coupled to ordinary matter, so they don't show up in particle colliders and terrestrial experiments. So any questions about that?
So in this whole picture, what we did is we solving the wave equation, we showed that there are some bound modes, means having this Schrodinger equation, we showed that there will be some bound modes, and we are saying those bound modes can lead to instability.
So we're showing that instead of having these waves that would go out and come back, we have these modes that die off exponentially in infinity and sort of sit around this radius, right? If we have one of those bound modes and we choose the real frequency to be in this regime, basically we know that if we have any sort of flex on the black hole horizon, that it has to extract energy. You're not allowed to put energy into the black hole, because that would actually make the that would violate the black hole's second law.
So then, if you have black hole and this ultralight boson cloud, because it satisfies that condition, like omega is going to be approached that, then it's going to be extracting energy, so it's going to be slowing down the black hole.
Yeah, exactly.
So in the end, of like once you get a steady state solution, how does that, like the stable light configuration look like?
Yeah, so exactly. So basically, if you assume that you just have some ultralight boson, doesn't have any, you know, additional self interactions or anything, then what happens is it'll actually, yeah, just take energy out of the black hole, you put it in the cloud, it'll grow exponentially for some period of time. And at some point, you can't just treat it as a test field. You have to start its back reaction on the black hole. What will happen is actually omega H will start to decrease, right? Because the black hole is losing angular momentum, spinning slower and slower. And so this will actually decrease until it basically reaches this value. And in that case, you know, basically the cloud and the black hole are rotating with the same angular velocity. And the instability was sort of shut off. And in that case, you actually expect, on the one hand, you can then go to higher azimuthal numbers and have those modes grow. Because you know, if you saturate the m equals 1, you can go to m equals 2 and so on. As you increase the azimuthal number, those are a lot slower. So actually what will probably happen is that before that, this cloud will actually emit gravitational waves. The oscillations will emit gravitational waves and it'll dissipate that way. Okay, so I think that's a good place to end. Again, just mentioned that this sort of includes our discussion of Kerr black holes. So starting tomorrow, we'll kind of shift from thinking about the Einstein equations as just some solution giving you some, or some set of equations that gives you some stationary space-time that exists for all time, and we'll kind of shift to thinking about them as evolution equations, where we send some initial conditions, and then the Einstein equations tell us what happens at a later time. So thank you, and see you.